Let's hear now a startling statistic. A quarter of all public school children in the U.S. are Latino, but only 3% of children's books are by or about Latinos. Quite simply, when it comes to diversity, children's books are, well, failing. That's according to a report by the University of Wisconsin-Madison. As part of our series on children in media, NPR's Elizabeth Blair tried to find out why children's books are so white.
8-year-old Havana Machado likes Dr. Seuss and Diary of a Wimpy Kid, but a mother's influence can be a powerful thing.
These are my American Girl doll books. One is Meet Josephina, and the other is Marisol.
Characters she likes because they look a lot like her, with long dark hair and olive skin. Havana Machado has lots of books with strong Latinas because her mother insists on it.
But you do have to look.
Melinda Machado grew up in San Antonio, Texas. Her family is from Cuba and Mexico. She says she didn't see Latino characters in books when she was a little girl, so she makes sure her daughter does.
I think children today are told you can be anything, but if they don't see themselves in the story, I think as they get older, they're going to question, can I really?
Only a small fraction of children's books have main characters that are Latino or Native American or Black or Asian. And it's been that way for a very long time. In 1965, the Saturday Review ran an article with the headline, "The All-White World of Children's Books." 1965. Megan Schliessman, a librarian with the Cooperative Children's Book Center, thinks the reason we're still talking about it is money.
I think there's a lot of concern and fear that multicultural literature is not going to sell enough to sustain a company.
That's a myth, says Schliessman, because there are companies publishing multicultural children's books that are profitable. Take a book about the real-life African-American Deputy U.S. Marshal Bass Reeves.
Bass hollered from the saddle of his stallion, warning Webb to give up. The outlaw bolted. Bass shook his head. He hated bloodshed, but Webb might need killing.
Bad news for outlaws. The remarkable life of Bass Reeves, Deputy U.S. Marshal, won awards and got attention from libraries and independent bookstores. It became a bestseller for the publisher Lerner Books.
There is an enormous amount of demand for this kind of content from libraries.
Andrew Carr is an editor with Lerner Books. He says public and school librarians try very hard to make sure there are books with a wide range of characters on the shelves. And while librarians are influential, they can't make a book sell.
There are something like 6,000 public libraries in the country. And, you know, even if they buy five copies of the book for their collection, it's still, that's not going to crack those bestseller lists of any kind, really.
Vonda Michonne Nelson wrote Bad News for Outlaws, as well as several other books about African Americans. She's also a librarian at the public library in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. She says young people need to see themselves represented on the page so that they'll continue reading.
If they don't see that, then perhaps they lose interest. They don't think there's anything in books about them or for them.
And she says it's also important for white children to see characters of different races.
Not only do they learn to appreciate the differences, but I think they learn to see the sameness. And so those other cultures are less seen as others.
Nelson says she understands that publishers are going to respond to what the market demands. And right now, the vast majority of best-selling children's books are by and about white people. But as the U.S. population changes, Melinda Machado thinks so will the books American children read.
I think eventually the demographics and the economic power will catch up. Will it catch up in while my daughter's still a child? Probably not.
Publishers might want to catch up a lot sooner. According to new data from the Census Bureau, nearly half of today's children under 5 years old are non-white. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm David Green. Good morning. We're digging deeper into the relationship between drug makers and the doctors who prescribe their drugs. Bistolic is a popular high blood pressure medication. It's made by Forest Laboratories. ProPublica, the nonprofit investigative news organization, examined new data and found that frequent prescribers of this drug often have financial ties to the drug's maker. We sat down with ProPublica reporter Charles Ornstein. He explained why this is significant.
What's new here is that we obtained information from Medicare. Medicare pays for about one out of every four prescriptions in the country. And so we took this data and linked it up with the payment data that we received to look for any connections that may exist there.
Okay, what connections did you find?
We found that with a number of really highly marketed drugs, drugs like Bistolic, that many of the top prescribers of those drugs within the Medicare program also receive money for speaking from the companies that made those drugs.
And this is something, though, that we believe might have been going on for a long time. I mean, pharmaceutical companies have always been accused of...
That's right. Pharmaceutical companies have had access to this data. They've paid millions of dollars for it every year. So they know what they spend on doctors for speaking and consulting. And then they track very, very closely their return on investment. We've seen this pop up in dribs and drabs in these whistleblower lawsuits where they make mention to the analyses that these companies do, their return on investment analyses, and where they track it super closely. But as a public, we have not known the drugs that doctors prescribe, nor have we known sort of the contours of how these relationships affect prescribing.
Okay, so you looked closely at this one drug, Bistolic, for high blood pressure, and you found that doctors who are getting money from the company that makes it are some of the biggest prescribers of the drug over generic alternatives. What has been the response from the people involved, the company and these physicians?
So it's 17 of the 20 top prescribing doctors are speakers for the maker Forest. These doctors say that they think that this drug is better. This drug has fewer side effects than other, these are called beta blockers. So it has fewer side effects than other beta blockers, and they think that it just works well for their patients. But as we talked to experts across the country, what they said to us was that they did not think that there was any evidence to show that this drug was any better than the existing beta blockers, but it certainly was a lot more expensive.
What about the company, Forest Labs? What are they? How have they responded to this?
They responded to us that this is an important treatment option, that it had undergone studies and it performed well, but they didn't reiterate the point that it was superior. They just called it an important treatment option. I think what you find with a lot of pharmaceutical companies is they're sort of boxed in by what the FDA allows them to say. So the phrase important treatment option is one that you hear a lot by companies to promote their drugs.
So you're getting some corporate speak here, but corporate speak that they have to do.
Absolutely.
You mentioned money. These doctors are prescribing this drug, Bistolic, over the generic alternatives. That's probably costing the government a lot more money since, you know, generics are usually cheaper.
Right. So one prescription for Bistolic is about $80 a month. By comparison, a prescription for a generic is less than $10 a month. So that's a difference of about $70 per prescription. If you multiply that by a million prescriptions, you're at $70 million. And the federal government is paying a big chunk of that in terms of the subsidies it's providing in Medicare Part D, which is the name of the drug plan. So that's just one drug. If you add in a whole bunch of drugs, you can see how this starts adding up to real money.
Could there be cases where doctors are prescribing something more often than they should that might not be as effective in terms of treating? I mean, where you could actually dealing with someone's health here.
When you look at the diabetes drug Avandia, which is a drug that a couple years ago was restricted because of risk that came to light, GlaxoSmithKline, which is the maker of Avandia, was spending a lot of money on physicians to speak on its behalf. And so the question that we weren't able to answer because our data is more recent is, you know, was there a connection back then? But I think that as new risks of drugs come out, we'll now have the information to look back and see are the top prescribers of those drugs also people who have financial relationships with the company, and then we'll be able to put the pieces together and do the analysis.
So what you're saying is that as we get more of these numbers, I mean, a lot more investigation to do, there could be times where someone might be prescribed a drug from a doctor who's getting money from a company and actually a different drug might be better for them.
Well, we can't turn the page backward. Beginning next year, every drug company and every medical device company is going to have to begin reporting the payments that they make to doctors across the country. That's going to be a totally new universe. Right now, we're talking only about 15 drug companies that we know about. You also can't take back this information that we're getting from Medicare. So when you put this together, you're going to learn a lot more about how these relationships affect physicians and their prescribing.
Charles, thanks so much. Thanks for bringing this report to us.
Thanks for having me.
He's a reporter for ProPublica, the nonprofit investigative news organization. The Rolling Stones are Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Charlie Watts, and Ronnie Wood. And some say the fifth Stone is Chuck Lavelle. He's been in the band's keyboard chair for more than three decades. His nimble fingers bring to life songs like Honky Tonk Women.
Give me the honky tonk blues. All right, honky tonk blues. fingers are moving. That's Chuck Lavelle playing with the Rolling Stones during their current 50 and counting tour. The band performed in Washington, D.C. last night, and Lavelle stopped by our studios to talk about touring with the Stones and a whole lot more. Chuck Lavelle, welcome to the program.
Dave, it's so good to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Those fingers are really moving.
Well, I try to keep them that way, yeah, man.
Tell me why the piano. How did you get interested in that instrument?
Well, yeah, it's the fact is my mother taught me how to play, and she played for family enjoyment. Well, she wasn't a teacher or a professional or anything. You know, I'd tug on her skirt and say, Mama, play me something on the piano. Mm-hmm. And she would, and oh, I was just fascinated. You know, I love watching her hands go up and down the keyboard. And she would do a very interesting thing. She would say, well, Chuck, what would it sound like if there was a terrible storm outside? You know, and I'd rumble down on the low end, blah, 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 you know. And Chuck, what would it sound like if you hit a home run? So music for me has always been about colors, emotions, and feelings rather than notes on the page or chords.
You knew really early on that you wanted to make music a career. And by age 20, you were asked to become part of the Allman Brothers.
I had moved to Macon, Georgia, and was looking for opportunity because there was a record label there called Capricorn Records. It was kind of climbing up the ladder over a period of a couple of years, and then members of the Allmans had found out about me. And this is after the tragic death of Duane Allman. You know, I think it was interesting and probably a good thing that the band did not look to try to replace Duane with another guitar player, because you just don't replace Duane Allman.
Irreplaceable.
And to go in a different direction and to, you know, put a piano in that role was, well, certainly good for me. And so this brought a whole other texture of sound into the band, you know, having a piano. So you look at a song like Jessica, which has kind of become a signature song for me and still enjoy hearing today. You add the blend between the Hammond B3 and the piano and the guitar.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy hearing it because we wanted to play it with it.
Cool.
So after the Allman Brothers, Chuck Lavelle, you played with a fusion group called Sea Level, and then not too long after that, you encountered the Rolling Stones for the first time. What was that meeting like?
It was amazing. You know, Sea Level had actually broken up, and I kind of went home despondent one day talking to my wife, Rose Lane, and I said, Rosie, you know, phone hadn't been ringing, career's not exactly taken off. Maybe I should just not worry about music for a while. And she listened very patiently. And then she said, well, that's all fine and good, Chuck, but guess what? The Rolling Stones called you today.
You're kidding. That's amazing. You're thinking that your music career might be over, and she says, oh, by the way, the Stones gave you a phone call.
Absolutely true.
Well, now you're the musical director. I mean, I've read you say that it's your job to keep Mick, Keith, Charlie, and Ronnie, the members of the Stones, happy. What does that mean?
You think about what Mick Jagger is doing up there. You know, he's got so much on his mind when he's performing.
It's like one of the most active performers in the history of rock and roll.
Absolutely, you know, and so there's points in a song where, uh-oh, where are we? Or is the bridge coming up? Or is the solo coming up? And if anybody has any doubts, they can look at me, and I can give hand signals or signals with my eyes to say, you know, yeah, we're going here or we're going there.
I love this image of Mick Jagger sometimes being so into the crowd and the moment that, I mean, he gets a little distracted and needs to kind of look over at you to get his place back.
Well, it's an enjoyable role for me. But I mean, let's face it, you know, musically, from the piano standpoint of view, there are some songs that I get to stretch a little bit on. But it's not the kind of band that offers a piano player a tremendous amount of improvisation.
You do get some ribbing, though, from the other members of the Stones for sort of your other life. You do conservation work. You're a tree farmer. Tell me how that all came about.
Well, I like to say it's all my wife's fault.
I like to say that a lot, too.
Blame it on the wife. By the way, Rose Lane and I will be celebrating our 40th anniversary.
Congratulations for that. That's really
Thank
cool.
Thank you. So the story is that, unbeknownst to me, I was dating the farmer's daughter. So as I spent time with the family, walking the woods, seeing the deep passion and dedication that they had for the land, it began to rub off on me. And then in 1981, her grandmother passed away, left her a parcel of land, and it became our responsibility to carry on this heritage of stewardship. So the more I studied up on forestry, the more interested I became. And of course, the direct connection is that where does this marvelous instrument that's given me my career and so much joy, where does it come from? From the resource of wood.
Listening to you talk about the woods, you have a solo album that really harkens to this influence. It's called Back to the woods.
Back to the woods. The theme of the album is a tribute to pioneering blues piano players.
This is a song called I Gotta Go Blues.
Yeah.
Gotta go, leave my baby be. Gotta go, leave my baby be. I love my woman, she don't care for me.
By the way, the vocalist on that track is a good friend of mine, Bruce Hampton, from down in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was a joy to have him make a guest appearance on the record.
Chuck Lavelle, you are in a sort of a unique role in music. You're in the Allman Brothers and the Stones. You're the fifth Stone, quote unquote. I mean, do you like that role, or looking back, would you have preferred to kind of just have one identity, one band?
The joy of my career has been dancing with all these different partners. You know, I spent 2 years with Eric Clapton. We did the Unplugged record together. Played on George Harrison's last solo tour, which was, are you kidding me, you know, to work with George Harrison, and, you know, done session work with Aretha Franklin recently on John Mayer's last record. So that's been the joy of my career. You learn something from one setting, you apply it to another, and it's just been tremendous for my career.
Well, if you see Mick Jagger playing on stage and you see him look back to kind of take a look over and find his place in the song, he'll be looking at the man I'm talking to, Chuck Lavelle. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, great to be with you. Thank you.
Chuck Lavelle, he's keyboardist for the Rolling Stones. He's also co-founder of the environmental site Mother Nature Network. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Now, a couple of notes about summer reading. First, NPR's Backseat Book Club. Our pick this month is a novel called Glory Be by Augustus Scattergood. It's set in 1969 in Hanging Moss, Mississippi. It's the story of Glory, a girl who loves to read Nancy Drew and can sense that her town is on the verge of changing forever. You can send questions for the author. Email us at backseatbookclub@npr.org or send a tweet. We are at NPR. Backseat.
We also need your help with a new project. NPR Books is building the Ultimate Kids Bookshelf, a list of 100 titles that every 9 to 14-year-old should read. So, what books did you love at that age? What books do your kids love now? Make your nominations at npr.org.
This is NPR News. Ella Fitzgerald was known as the First Lady of Song, but Carla Bruni was the singer-songwriter of First Ladies. The Italian-born globe-trotting fashion model and girlfriend to rock stars and philosophers recorded a French and international hit in 2002, Someone Told Me, Quelqu'un M'a Dit.
On dit que le destin se moque bien de nous, qu'il ne nous donne rien et qu'il nous promet tout. Paraît que le bonheur est à portée de main. Alors on tend la main et on se retrouve fou. Pourtant quelqu'un m'a dit que tu m'aimes encore. C'est quelqu'un qui m'a dit.
Then, in 2008, Carla Bruni married Nicolas Sarkozy, who was then president of France, and she became, literally, a rock star first lady. Now, with Sarkozy out of office, she's released a new album, Little French Songs. Although, as you'll hear, I've just mispronounced that title.
Quand tout va mal, when life goes wrong, try for a little French song.
Carla Bruni, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
And I gather that that this album, Little French Songs, has been in the works for quite some time. Did you wait until you were no longer, as we would say, the First Lady of France to release it?
Well, what happened, it was a mix of circumstances. I did wait until my husband was not the president of France anymore, but I also waited because I had a little girl, a baby girl, so I had really no choice, and I gave priority to, you know, the baby, of course, and so I did it piece by piece. Yeah. I wrote the album, then I recorded the album in another time, and then I released the album instead of doing it all at once, like most songwriters do.
But does this mark a change of a period in your life where now, for now, you're back to being an artist, and you're not, for now at least, you're not the First Lady of France.
Oh, yeah. It's so nice. I mean, it was great. You know, it was a great honor and a great experience. But talking about the music, it just makes it easier, you know, and also for touring, no security problem, no, you know, it just makes it easy to be an artist for me, definitely.
Dans les bagnoles, au Batignolles, à Istanbul, avenue du Roule.
This is one of the songs from the album. It's Chez Keith et Anita, I guess we'd say, with Keith and Anita.
At Keith and Anita.
At Keith and Anita's place or whatever.
It was very much related to a photograph shoot that was made in a house in the south of France by Dominique Tarlet, this French photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And this was made at Keith, Richard and Anita Pallenberg's house. And this was in the 70s, so I was just born, you know, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not like a personal experience.
Quelqu'un joue du Chopin, on est chez Keith et Anita. Quelqu'un joue du Chopin, on est chez Keith et Anita.
You know, when I saw those pictures and I heard of this album that came out from that time, it was called Exile on Main Street, a Rolling Stone album. And the picture was showing such a style of life, such a quiet freedom. You know, the 60s and the 70s were very different times. So I guess it would be a song about those years, you know, that no one really remembers now, but we still have the music that came out from those years, the fashion, you know, the look.
You know what they say about no one remembers. They're saying they're so stoned at the time they can't remember what was happening in the 1970s.
I remember the first sentence of Keith Richards' biography says, believe it or not, I remember everything.
C'était l'été 70, je ne savais rien de tout ça, et pourtant je vivais chez Keith.
Do you realize how hard it is for Americans to wrap their minds around the thought that this song about nostalgia for Keith Richards and Anita Pallenberg, the Rolling Stones, and the glamorous life of the wild 60s, that was the wife of the President of the Republic? Do you realize how odd that is for us?
Yes. Well, you know, I happen to fall in love with this man, and he was the President of the Republic. But I understand that it might be strange from outside. Of course, from inside, it's just my man and my husband. And the point for me was to be, you know, next to him and to try to help him through his job, if I can use that word.
Mon Raymond est là tout bon, c'est de la valeur authentique. Pour franchir le Rubicon, on ne peut pas dire qu'il hésite. Mon Raymond est là canon, c'est de la bombe atomique. Quand il est beau, nom de nom, l'air en devient électrique.
The song on Little French Songs, Mon Raymond, my Raymond. Your Raymond, I assume, is not named Raymond.
No.
This is why do you refer to your husband as Raymond?
Well, it was kind of a blink, you know, because as you said, he's so famous anyway that I wasn't going to sing Nicholas, you know, and I tried.
You tried to write a song around Nicholas?
There was already a song from a very famous French singer called Sylvie Vartan, and that was called Nicholas. So that was a song from the 80s. That was sort of a hit, you know. So, and then I was trying to find another name for him, and I hesitated in between Raymond, but also Roger, you know, Roger.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also thought of Raoul.
Raoul,
Raoul. But, you know, Raoul is not so cool for rhymes, you know. You have cool, but not so many other rhymes. Raymond, you have a lot. It's a round sound. Also, it's a sort of an old-fashioned name, you know. For us in France, Raymond was more the people from the 40s, the 50s. I thought it was funny to use such a name to describe him, quite precisely.
Mon Raymond, il vient d'ailleurs, et personne n'a ses manières, ni de dire, ni de faire, ni de goûter au banal.
And you have no shortage of rhymes. Raymond, il a tout bon. Raymond, il a
des noms. I'm not going to say right. Raymond is no good.
He's all good.
Yeah, he's all good. He's to all me, good. Anyway.
It's quite a description of your husband. He's an atomic bomb. He's electric. He's dynamic.
Definitely. Yeah.
This is a realistic, as far as things go, a realistic
this
depiction.
This is a very lucid and realistic description of him, yeah. And loving, of course, you know. Ma chanson pour toi, Raymond. Ma chanson pour toi, Raymond.
The name in France, the name of this CD.
Little French Song.
Oh, the name is in franglais in France.
Yes, the name is in franglais. Yes, I thought it was fun to also use an English title to describe such a French thing, you know.
So it's not Petite Chanson Française.
Petite Chanson Française, no.
And it's not Little French Songs, it's Little French Songs.
Exactly.
That's so exactly it.
Yes, exactly.
Well, welcome back to the... singer-songwriting ranks here.
Thank you very much.
It's very nice to talk with you today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This week, the Obama administration announced an effort to promote the new health insurance marketplaces to Latinos. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius will make the rounds on Spanish-language media. Under the Affordable Care Act, people can start signing up to get insurance through the marketplaces on October 1st. Some 10 million Latinos could gain coverage. Advocacy groups are trying to help Latinos sign up, as we hear from Jenny Gold in Maryland.
It's a crowded morning at the legal clinic at Casa de Maryland, a nonprofit in suburban Washington serving the local Latino community. Elba Haldin makes the rounds with her clipboard and health pamphlets. She's one of the center's 20 promotoras, health promoters, who help explain things like vaccinations and diabetes to anyone coming in.
Tenemos la edad. La edad es un signo también de riesgo porque usted sabe que empieza la mujer después de los 40.
Today, she's telling women about breast cancer risk. Soon, she'll also be telling people like Andrea Velandia how to sign up for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Velandia is at Casa de Maryland with her toddler and newborn for help finishing her citizenship papers. Right now, like many Latinos, she's young and uninsured.
I just think it's very expensive to go to a doctor to get a regular checkup, whatever you're doing, a test or anything. It's just a lot of money. And you only have an option to go to the emergency room, which is even more expensive, I guess.
So far, she's been able to make do.
We're very healthy. Like, we don't have, like, many issues.
And that makes her just the sort of person Obamacare needs most. The more young and healthy people who buy insurance in the new marketplaces, the less insurers have to pay in claims, and the lower premiums will be. And so the state gave Casa de Maryland a grant to hire a dozen new employees called navigators to work full-time on enrollment in their centers. Here's Health Director George Escobar.
Plus, we'll have navigators, basically mobile navigators, that will be working in the community, that will be enrolling, educating and enrolling people in businesses, at supermarkets, at community events, weekends, evenings.
It may not be easy. The debate over the Affordable Care Act a few years ago focused largely on Latinos who are not eligible, undocumented immigrants. Jennifer Nandu works on health policy at the National Council of La Raza.
So the takeaway often from that public message was there isn't really anything in the Affordable Care Act for the Latino community. Many people forgot to talk about the fact that there are a broad set of Latinos, in fact, most who are here lawfully present and who will gain the benefits of the Affordable Care Act.
She says the current debate over immigration reform is adding more fear and confusion, especially in families where some people are citizens and others are not.
Even if everyone in that household is legal, they still have different eligibility from each other. And so teasing all of that out can be difficult.
In California, Spanish language media are proving to be a key part of the push. The California Endowment, a foundation based in L.A., is sponsoring a series of ads on Spanish networks Univision, Telemundo, and Impremedia. One of them features celebrity psychologist Doctora Isabel.
Le saluda la Doctora Isabel una vez más para contarle sobre los beneficios.
Dr. Isabel's ad is a good example of how you have to tailor the message for the audience.
Daniel Zingale runs the endowment's outreach campaign. He says it's not enough just to translate an English ad into Spanish. You also have to address the cultural differences. He points to an ad in English featuring Dr. Oz.
The new healthcare law has so much in it that could help Californians get better and more affordable healthcare. Get educated, get engaged, get enrolled.
In the Dr. Oz ad, he speaks in language that's very familiar to those in mainstream English language press. But in the Spanish language ad with Dr. Isabel, she describes Obamacare as a blessing. And we learned early on that that was the language that was appropriate to that audience.
That message will also reach the millions of undocumented Latino immigrants, but the law bars them from purchasing insurance on the exchanges. Casa de Maryland's George Escobar says their job is not only to enroll people who do qualify, it's also to help those who don't find other options for care. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Gold.
Jenny Gold is with our partner, Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service.
This is NPR News.